Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today's live music comes to us from the Brooklyn art rock band Dirty Projectors. They're a band that numbers among its fans David Byrne, Bjork, and many music critics. Many, but not all. A reviewer in the British music magazine The Fly wrote, "Weird doesn't cover it. More a collection of sonic mind boggles than a coherent album." And The Guardian's reviewer last year wrote that she really wanted to like Dirty Projectors, but that it's, quote, like trying to hug a porcupine. I'm not making a really strong case for this, am I? But see, here's the thing. Sometimes critics get it wrong. I mean, really wrong. Like General Custer saying, "Over that hill, I think there's friendly Indians," wrong, if I can steal a line from The Honeymooners. You would not believe some of the albums, some of the great albums of our time that got panned when they came out. We'll talk about that in a moment, but just to give you a little historical perspective, even some of the greatest composers in music history got shredded by baffled critics. Opera composer Richard Wagner was referred to by one reviewer as a demented eunuch, which is pretty tame compared to what J.L. Klein wrote about him in 1871. He called Wagner's music, quote, "the diabolical din of this pig-headed man, inflated by Mephistopheles' mephitic and most venomous hellish miasma into Beelzebub's court composer and general director of hell's music." There's a lot of big words in there, and I don't think he meant that in a good way. That quote, by the way, comes from a great book called A Lexicon of Musical Invective by the late composer Nicholas Slonimsky. It's a hilarious collection of terrible reviews of composers and works that we now revere as high points of Western culture, like when the American critic Philip Hale in 1899 wrote this, quote, "The finale is for the most part vulgar and dull. Oh, the pages of stupid and hopelessly vulgar music, the unspeakable cheapness of the chief tune." What is this stupid and vulgar music? Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and especially the Ode to Joy, received actually quite a few nasty reviews in its day. One critic called it obstreperous roaring, and another claimed it was incoherent and questioned Beethoven's sanity. Even a reviewer of intelligence and skill didn't always get it right. The great George Bernard Shaw wrote a lot of music criticism, and in 1893 he called Brahms, quote, "a great baby, rather tiresomely addicted to dressing himself up as Handel or Beethoven and making a prolonged and intolerable noise." Sometimes you have to wonder what these critics hated more, the music or the composer behind it. So let's bring this long and illustrious tradition of clueless critics a bit closer to our own day. In a moment, a couple of pop music classics get taken down a notch. And then when they're feeling better about me quoting their bad reviews, the band Dirty Projectors, who really are terrific, will play live. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We were just hearing about how even some of the greatest works of classical music were panned by critics who just didn't get it. So maybe it's not a surprise that some of the biggest names in Western pop and rock also got terrible reviews when they first came out. Nah, you'll still be surprised. Wait till you hear about the reviews that J. Edward Keyes has brought us today. Joe Keyes is editor-in-chief of eMusic. Joe, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So is this one of the perils of being a critic, the fear that if you really slam an album, you'll be held up as a buffoon by future generations?
Man, oh man, it really is. I think the peril gets amplified if you're dealing with the newest record by a band that's already established their legacy. I remember one of the times that I felt especially nervous about it was reviewing the Air record that came after Moon Safari, which was a really, at the time, really well-regarded record.
This is the French electronic
group. The French electronic group Air. And at the time, Moon Safari was a cult classic, but still really well-regarded, and they were regarded as innovators. And the record that came after that, I just thought was terrible. And I listened to it again and again and again, and I just didn't get it. So I went out on a limb and panned it. And fortunately, now, decades on, it's that sort of was born out. But I remember writing that review just being petrified. And you encounter that fear of wanting to backpedal a little bit.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, some of the most memorable reviews that I've ever read were the real, you know, the slams, you know, the ones where you just rip an album or a concert or a show or a book or whatever, a film apart. You know, it can be fun to write and to read that kind of thing.
It definitely can. I think the reviews that we're going to be talking about today, one of the things I love about them so much is you do get a charge from seeing somebody do just a really well-executed takedown. The most fun ones to me are the ones that, you know, I like to think of it as sort of speaking truth to power, as it were. It's not as fun to see a takedown of a small band, but if you go after a big star and really nail it, I feel like there's something gratifying about that for the reader.
But then, of course, as we've seen, there is always the chance that the album you're ripping apart will turn out to be a classic. I wonder what Arthur Schmidt now thinks of his 1968 Rolling Stone review of Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends. Here's a quote. He says, the album is worth getting if only for the cover, which captures the amazing resemblance of Simon and Garfunkel to Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, which had never occurred to me before. He has now ruined that album cover for me for the rest of my life. Bookends is considered an American classic. How does somebody get it so wrong?
It certainly is considered an American classic now. I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that we do have the benefit of history in seeing all the other artists that it's influenced from, everyone like people like Elliott Smith and Belle and Sebastian to much more popular bands. So we can look back and see its influence. But at the time, he was sort of reviewing this in a vacuum. And I'll even put myself out on a limb here a little bit as admittedly really not the biggest Simon and Garfunkel fan. I think he maybe got a few things right in this review.
There are the hits, and then there's certainly some filler amongst the Thriller on this record. But my goodness, the hits on this record, they just kept coming, and they began with this one.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson.
Mrs. Robinson from Simon and Garfunkel's 1968 album Bookends, which also features A Hazy Shade of Winter and the classic America. So there's a lot of great music here. It was a number one album on the Billboard pop album charts, but Joe, Rolling Stone, Arthur Schmidt in Rolling Stone, giving it a poor review. And he must have known at the time that this was, as you said before, this was an established band. He wasn't just, you know, taking a hack at some kids who were making their first record.
No, and I think that there's a sense of glee even with the line that you referenced before, where he just opens the review by taking down their appearance immediately and then just goes from there. So I think he knew what he was doing. I also like the little zinger he gets in about Paul Simon calling him the most self-consciously poetic of and arty of rock lyrics, which may play as a compliment, but feels like a bit of a dig in this context.
And perhaps 40 years later, he might still have written something like that. why would, you know, general consensus and critical opinion be so out of step? I mean, it doesn't happen often. But when it does, you know, we get these moments where we look back and say, wow, what was he or she thinking?
It's a tricky thing. I mean, as a critic, I think there's a tendency, at least for me when I write, to not be overly swayed by popular opinion. And I feel like there's a danger to swing back hard in the other direction because you don't want to look like you're under the sway of trends. You don't want to look like you're under the sway of groupthink. And you can kind of convince yourself into thinking that you're reviewing this in a vacuum that's not swayed by those things. Well, one of the dangers in operating that way is that you can produce reviews like this that are so out of step with popular opinion that you end up looking foolish after a few years have gone by.
And, you know, this has been more of a problem in classical music where there have been fewer and fewer people covering it. But I know a lot of critics who feel like it's their mission to advocate, not to, you know, kind of slam or tear down because, you know, they feel a kind of responsibility to the music. Now, in the pop music world, obviously, there's lots of people competing for your eyes and your ears and, you know, a real kind of funny takedown of a big album can get you noticed.
Absolutely. I mean, and I love that idea of advocacy, especially in pop music when it comes to smaller bands, really being an advocate for smaller bands. But you make a good point in that a well-timed takedown can elevate a writer whose byline isn't very well known to becoming, you know, the guy who took down Arcade Fire or whoever it happens to be.
We're speaking with J. Edward Keyes. He's editor-in-chief at eMusic. And Joe and I are sampling some fun reviews from the past that seem to have gotten it wrong. Here's an album from 1969 that it sort of boggles the mind that anybody could have given this a bad review.
One of the few things I'm noted for, having dissed the Beatles, was a, you know, pretty close to a capital crime back in those days. I have changed my views slightly towards the positive. You know, time has a way of doing that. I have had to reconsider, but it's still not as coherent as the sound of a band in the process of breaking up.
That is Ed Ward, who gave the Beatles' Abbey Road a scathing review in a 1969 edition of Rolling Stone, talking with us on the phone from his home in a small town in France. God, Joey had to actually leave the continent after writing that review. So now Rolling Stone is on a limb, too, when they get this review from Ed Ward. You know, the Beatles are at the height of their fame, and this guy is saying, this record's garbage. So what do you do as a publisher slash editor?
Absolutely. And one of the things that they kind of did in this instance was when they saw how negative Ed's review was, and just as a sidebar, there are not enough words in the English language to describe how much I love Ed's review of this record. but you could almost feel them getting nervous as it submitted. So they kind of countered a little bit, and they had John Mendelsohn submit a positive review, which took some of the weight off a little bit. And then it was like, well, here's two opinions. Right. You decide. You choose which one you want.
So give me some of the bleeding chunks from Ed's review. What makes it such a classic?
I mean, the opening line is, eek, it's the Beatles. And then right after that, he gets this great diss where he's describing the cover. And he says, up the block a ways, a police van is watching. But it's cool because they're using the pedestrian crossing. Like, just digs at their kind of counterculture aspect. And it's cool. They're using the pedestrian walkway.
Well, and then he, you know, as we just heard, he says, you know, time has softened his opinion. I mean, this is considered one of the greatest albums of the rock era. I think it's like number 14 on Rolling Stone's list of the top 500 albums of all time. And yet, Ed Ward stands by at least one part of this review. He hates that medley on side two.
The thing that really disappointed me the most was on side two of the album, and we were dealing with a vinyl album, of course, there was this so-called suite of songs, which were sounded to me like sketches that they had done in the studio and then sort of sweetened up and had George Martin knit them together. And they were just annoying, you know. It was filler. It was throwaway. There had never been filler and throwaway on a Beatles album before, really.
Bit of the medley, and that is how it's listed on the album track listing, the Beatles Abbey Road. Carry That Weight, The End. I mean, as Ed Ward said, Joe, sort of unapologetically, you know, they're a series of sketches. But on the other hand, A Day in the Life was a series of sketches that were sort of cobbled together into a great song.
I do disagree with Ed on this point. I think for me, one of my favorite moments in all of rock music history is when Golden Slumber slams into Carry That Weight. I still get a charge every time I hear that. Also, just a little note, if you ever get the chance to do that at karaoke with a group of people, and you can, it's a possibility. It's in karaoke.
No, it is not a possibility with me.
It is just as much
fun. Just not going to happen. So Abbey Road, widely regarded now as one of the best constructed of the Beatles records, such a bad review in Rolling Stone that Jan Wenner and the rest of the Rolling Stone gang went out and commissioned a favorable review.
Yeah.
Is that cricket? I mean, can they do that?
I sort of don't like it when that happens because I feel like they're trying to sort of, forgive the cliche, but have their cake and eat it too. They don't want to commit to one opinion, so they waffle a little bit. Now, there's another time that they did this, and it happened in the 90s. They didn't print the negative review, and it's...
Wow.
Certainly,
well,
that's
even worse, it seems.
Yeah, it's certainly not with the Beatles, but the band was Hootie and the Blowfish.
Uh-huh.
And it was the second Hootie and the Blowfish record that Jim DeRogatis sort of famously wrote a very negative review of. It ended up...
Gee, what a surprise. Jim DeRogatis
exactly.
Not liking a record?
And he is very good at that. According to him, it sort of had a lot of professional repercussions, but they just killed his review entirely of the second Hootie and the Blowfish record and ran a positive review, which, if you ask me, was the bad choice. I think history has sort of proven it that way.
Well, now, I suppose we could do a whole nother segment where we turn this idea around.
Exactly.
Great reviews of albums that turned out to be clunkers. But what we're doing instead is we're talking about terrible reviews of albums that turned out to be classics. Now, we heard from Ed Ward. On our website, you can hear Ed tell a bonus story about the day he received the Abbey Road record. The delivery came by truck, and it included a record that Ed Ward would go on to give glowing marks to from the Stooges, Iggy and the Stooges. So a man who did have some taste.
Good taste on that one. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So we've been talking so far about, like, the past, the sort of far in the past. What's more, give us a more recent example of an album that just sort of baffled the critic who was assigned to write about it.
Well, I think one of the ones that comes to mind, and it was right before they had their both critical and commercial resurgence, was the Flaming Lips record Zyreka. What they did, it was several albums removed from their one hit in the 90s, She Don't Use Jelly. It was about two albums later, and there was really some question as to where this band was going to end up, if they were just going to end up in the dustbin of history or emerge as an artistic force. So they decided to release this collection of four CDs. Now, this was pre-internet, pre-home mixing gear, so it was four separate CDs. They all contained the same songs, but it was designed to be played simultaneously with you and your friends.
So each CD had different tracks of the same song, different, like, you know, so voices one and three were on this CD, guitar one and bass were on that CD. Right? So the idea was you had to play all four CDs at once to get the full effect.
Exactly. It sort of came out of, at the time, Wayne Coyne was doing these events where he would have people...
The leader of Flaming Lips.
Wayne Coyne, the frontman from the Flaming Lips, would do these events where he would have people gather in parking garages and big theaters with and bring their boomboxes, and he'd give them all a tape and have them play it simultaneously. That gradually evolved into this Zyreka project, which ended up being kind of stunningly forward-thinking at the time. The idea that you are in charge of the way the music sounds, which is something that we naturally all embrace now, but wasn't the case back then, and clearly sort of baffled the Pitchfork writer who was assigned to review it at the time.
And who gave it a 0.0.
0 out of 10. Didn't even really attempt to engage with it, and certainly didn't attempt to play it in the manner it was meant to be played either.
Now, Pitchfork, they too, you know, got eventually someone else to come along and do a more moderate review of the record, right?
They had Mark Richardson, who's actually editor-in-chief now. He got the opportunity to come in a few years later, and it was in light of Ryan Schreiber, who's one of the founders of Pitchfork, had done a negative review of the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, which had caused a bit of ire at the time. Mm. So they were kind of revisiting a lot of those opinions, and Mark came in and got a chance to really go to bat for Zyreka and talk really kind of beautifully about a personal experience he had the first time he heard the record with a bunch of other fans in a club, and really recontextualized it.
So this is a little bit from Zyreka, this 1997 album from the Flaming Lips that got an historic 0.0 first time out from Pitchfork. March of the Rotten Vegetables, that is music from the Flaming Lips record Zyreka, issued as four CDs. So it was, Joe, almost by force, a communal experience, because you had to have like three friends with their boomboxes or their CD players, plus you and your machine, to be able to get the full effect of this record.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think sets apart the original negative review from the revised review by Mark a few years later. One of the things that really stands out about the original review is that the writer almost makes a point of talking about how, I only listened to one CD, I listened to it alone, and I didn't like it. Whereas Mark's revised review several years later is all about hearing it with friends or hearing it in his apartment with his girlfriend's boombox, and it becomes a little more beautiful that way.
And sort of raises the question of, you know, when a record or any work of art is pushing the technology to the next level, is it threatening to leave behind the people who are listening to it, whether they're critics or listeners? And in the case of Zyreka, this Flaming Lips project, it's 15 years old now. So what does hindsight tell us? Is this a classic?
I think it's a well-regarded experiment, if not quite a classic. I feel like what it did for the Flaming Lips was very important in that it transitioned them from being a 90s sort of buzzbin band into a band that could make a serious artistic statement and had a lot of really interesting creative ideas just beyond coming up with clever words to rhyme with Vaseline. And it moved them into what became really, starting with the Soft Bulletin and there on out, just a series of really great, well-structured, well-considered records that established their reputation.
So kind of a watershed moment for them.
Absolutely, the turning point for sure.
All right, for the band Flaming Lips. So what do we take away from all this, Joe? I mean, whether we're talking about incomprehending critics who claim that Beethoven had to be insane to write this music, to Pitchfork giving a zero to an album that is now considered to be a turning point. How does that happen? How does history change the way we see any given moment along that musical continuum?
I think one of the natural things that happens with the passage of time is records have an opportunity to grow on you, and you hear nuances that you might have missed the first time, both collectively as a public and individually as a critic. A personal example of that, for a record that became monumentally important to me, that for the first 3 months I had it, I just didn't understand, was Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. That's one of my favorite records. But it took me several months of living with that record and learning those songs and hearing all the different nuances to fall in love with it.
Now, why would you do that? If you didn't like it the first time and then gave it another go and still didn't like it, why would you stick with it for a couple of months to get through that to the point where it became so important to you?
There are kind of two reasons that happens for me. The most common is that even if I don't like a record, and the Neutral Milk Hotel is a good example of that, I find that there's often a quality about it that I can't put my finger on that keeps compelling me to come back to it and figure out what's going on there. It's not merely bad, it's more puzzling. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a challenge for me to keep listening to it until I unlock that puzzle. Another reason that happens a little more rarely is hearing a lot of my peers whose opinions I respect talk about it very highly and just assuming there's something about this that I'm not understanding and working to want to understand that. And I think that can be a great experience and an experience everyone should have with records.
Yeah, I mean, my own experience with the Neutral Milk Hotel record was, you know, putting it on and thinking, oh, this is okay. Wow, now it's like really weird. And then at the end of the record saying, wow, what just happened here? And when you get that feeling, that's when you know you got to go back to track one and start over because there's something happening there. We've been speaking with Joe Keyes. J. Edward Keyes is editor-in-chief at eMusic about great music that got some terrible reviews early on. And Joe, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I enjoyed it too. Thanks.
This is Soundcheck.
When you were young, you were the king of cauliflowers. And how you built a tower tumbling through.
That's The King of Carrot Flowers, Part 1, from the Neutral Milk Hotel album called In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, a record that has aged pretty well. Coming up, the Brooklyn band Dirty Projectors earned lots of positive reviews for their latest album, Swing Low Magellan, which ended up on many best of lists for 2012. But they've received some harsh reviews, too, and we'll ask them about it. And Dirty Projectors will perform in our studio next. This is Soundcheck.
I love Soundcheck. I listen every day.
If the search has been long and futile and brutal, and if you squint trying to recollect the bosom of your hoodlum love, you reach out and and gasping, the vastness grabs you like an alien embrace.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last year, the band Dirty Projectors released their 7th full-length album called Swing Low Magellan. The record was widely acclaimed, as was its more recent follow-up, an EP named after this song, About to Die. Before Dirty Projectors kicks off 2013 with a performance at Carnegie Hall, they've trooped on here into our Soundcheck studio. Here is the band, Dirty Projectors, playing a song from that EP. It's called Here Till It Says I'm Not, live on Soundcheck. From within.
We both take diamonds from the mine. We both work on the archive. You invest power in your side. What you don't see shivers in the darkness of its black.
Band is Dirty Projectors, live in the Soundcheck studio with a song called Here Till It Says I'm Not. And let me introduce you to the members of Dirty Projectors here in the studio today. David Longstreth, singing and playing guitar. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
And Amber Kaufman, also at a microphone, one of the three other vocalists in the group.
Yeah.
Hi, Amber.
Hi.
Nat Baldwin is somewhere near a mic. He's playing the upright bass.
Woo-hoo. Yep.
Haley Deakle singing as well, and Olga Bell singing and playing some piano on the songs here in the studio today. So, David, first of all, let me ask, About to Die was a song on the LP.
Yes.
And then becomes kind of the title track of the EP. So do you see the EP as a kind of appendage to the record, to the full length?
Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad way to think about it. When we were recording Swing Low Magellan last year, 2011, wow. Okay, fair enough.
The wheels of music move slowly sometimes.
Yeah, they do, and the wheels of time move quickly.
Yeah.
We recorded a whole bunch of songs. We did it upstate in a house, and before we were recording, I was just writing music, and I just kind of kept on writing songs, and didn't really stop, so... When we were recording, we had just a ton of material kind of left over.
Mm-hmm. So these are your basement tapes, sort of.
I guess, yeah.
You talk about writing the songs, and I, it wouldn't surprise me to learn that the your kind of trademark vocal harmonies are all precisely notated and written out. But it also wouldn't surprise me to learn that you just kind of work it out in the studio. Amber, how do they happen?
they're not notated or written out. We just get together and memorize them and practice them.
Kind of just feel, you know, just kind of like improvise.
No. we don't improvise, but, you know, Dave writes them all out and then we get together and we work on them, work on all the tones and and all of that.
Uh-huh. So. But the initial ideas have to come from someplace. I mean, is it like, does David bring you the skeleton of the song and you sort of have to work it out?
No. For the most part, Dave puts the harmonies down and it's already there.
Well, that would sort of explain what our friend Gabriel Kahane heard in one of the songs on the record. The singer-songwriter pianist who's been here a number of times tweeted that one of the songs on the album, The Socialites, is straight up Schumann, hashtag in the best way. To which you replied, Dave, that you didn't quite get it. Are you a classical music fan at all? I mean, I know you've composed some pieces for the Bang on a Can All-Stars, but, I mean, have you listened to much classical music?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a time when I guess that's the main thing that I listened to. For whatever reason, I think just like the colors of that music and and the ability of like long instrumental music to really get into kind of abstract states of mind and feelings, I think was really my jam at one point. That said, I'm kind of spotty with how I know it, and somehow I had just overlooked Schumann. I've never checked out Schumann. I think, like, he wrote mostly songs, right?
He wrote a ton of songs, you know, voice and piano for the most part.
And I think there was, like, a little bit of, like, an uncanny valley thing happening for me with the Schumann songs where maybe I, like, listened to it and it was enough, like, pop music, which obviously is, like, or just, you know, rock music, the Beatles, all that. It's enough like that how different it was to me when I was a teenager checking it out. I was just like, I cannot do, you know, that's some other stuff.
We're speaking with the members of Dirty Projectors. You guys sound good unplugged. Do you do this sort of thing a lot?
We try.
Now and then.
Yeah. The performance with the group Y Music. So you'll have a chamber ensemble with you when you head out on stage at Carnegie Hall on the 11th.
That's right. You know, part of the Carnegie program is... we're making it with that in mind, the sense of trying to use like the natural acoustics of that space and take it down to like, you know, an acoustic level or almost an a cappella level. A lot of our music has you know, these 3- and 4-part vocal harmonies, so to try to use the natural acoustics of that space on some of this stuff is definitely, yeah, the idea of playing the show there.
And adding a chamber music ensemble to a rock band, you know, it kind of...
Heads into some dubious territory, potentially.
You know, that has been, like, one of the most vibrant parts of the music scene here in New York in recent years. It's been this so-called indie classical, alternative, whatever it is, where the musicians seem to be equally at home in both rock and chamber music. Mm.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the Y Music players are really, really incredible. We have had the chance to they recorded on Swing Low probably, 4 or 5 songs with us on that. And then just other little things here and there. Some of the string players from the group played with us on Letterman when we did About to Die. And yeah, I mean, exactly what you're talking about. Their level of like just... ease in the world of classical music, like notated music. Mm-hmm. And then their flexibility, though, just kind of like, you know, playing things in the way that we do or talking about them in the non-real musicological terms that we use.
Right, but you must feel comfortable with them. I mean, it, you know, that's a part of the music scene that it seems this band is kind of made for.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I tend to think of this band as its own thing, but... yeah, I mean, I definitely feel there's some kindred vibes with, yeah, all those guys. Nadia and Rob is incredible. Mm-hmm.
Rob Moose, Nadia Sirota. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great that they're going to be playing with us. They're also opening the show.
Mm-hmm. So Y Music with and opening for Dirty Projectors, Friday, January 11th, Carnegie Hall. Joe on Twitter asks, can we expect a new release this year? Boy, Joe is really, I mean, that's, you already gave him an LP and an EP.
What do you want? I hope so.
Okay.
We're working on a couple of different things right now. Mm-hmm. So, Joe, I think so.
All right. Now, Sean asks, love the piano. Would you ever release a live album?
We would love to do that. Yeah, definitely. We have taped a fair amount of shows at this point. Whether it would be the kind of thing that would be kind of like a collection of like different shows across, you know, a span of years, or whether it would be the kind of thing that it's like the 9:30 Club, you know,
right.
May 14th, 2014.
A document of a single show.
Yeah. We haven't quite gotten that far, but I love that idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
Well, also just that, the music does become something else. Like, one way or another, a lot of the recordings have ended up being kind of maps of ideas that really take on a physical presence or a collective feeling once we actually live inside of them for a while.
That's interesting. Amber, what Dave just said about, you know, the song is becoming kind of like taking on a physical presence. When I see you guys play live, especially when the three female voices are, you know, you're all close together on the stage or here in the studio and you're all singing, do you get that kind of sense of becoming part of like a single composite instrument where maybe you're not even sure who's singing what?
I guess it becomes, yeah, really automatic at a certain point, or, you know, you like when you first are singing these parts, you have to really think about your own part.
Right.
You know.
But, you know, Meredith Monk and the members of her vocal ensemble, they sometimes talk about in some of the more intricate stuff, once you've internalized, it's like you kind of forget who's doing what and you just become part of it. It's like this.
Yeah, I think
without being creepy about it, this kind of hive mind thing.
I think that is probably true for some of the stuff that we do that's like really fast back and forth, you know. You are in sort of a weird state of mind when you're singing that stuff. Oh, definitely.
We're speaking with the members of Dirty Projectors who are playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. This next song comes from the 2012 album, the full-length Swing Low Magellan. This is Dance For You. Once again, it's Dirty Projectors, live on Soundcheck.
I ran across cyanide plains, mind like a prison cell, but feet untethered and sad. I wandered out, hopeless and sad. No thought of where I'd go or how I'd ever get back. There is an answer, I haven't found it, but I will keep dancing till I do. Dance for you, dance for you. I boogie down Gargoyle streets, searching in every face for something I could believe. I knelt beneath 100 saints. Wanna feel the breath of a force I cannot explain. There is an answer, I haven't found it, but I will keep dancing till I do. Dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you, dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you. Dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you. Dance for you, dance for you. Dance for you.
Once again, the band Dirty Projectors live in the Soundcheck studio with the song Dance For You. And Dave, we were talking earlier today about great records that got panned by baffled or incomprehending reviewers when they first came out. I mean, the idea that Abbey Road could have gotten slammed in Rolling Stone magazine is still kind of baffling to me. You've had some experience with puzzled critics who don't know what to make of your stuff. I mean, what has your experience been?
Well, when I first heard Abbey Road, I didn't like it either.
You, the big Beatles fan.
Yeah, well, the first Beatles that I got into was the really early stuff. Because I was like into punk, you know, I liked that energy and just how raw it was. And then I think maybe I tried to jump the gun and go to, you know, one of the later records, maybe Abbey Road or the White Album or something. And then I just thought it was so cheesy. So I don't know. It all depends on context. You know, it depends on the ears that you're bringing to it. And
right. Well, now, your albums, even your early records, you know, they haven't been around that long where we have the benefit of a generation to kind of put them in context. But still, there has been some kind of consensus around a lot of the work that Dirty Projectors have done, and there have been some critics who just don't get it. Yeah. I mean, what do you do with that? Do you think, hey, the Beatles got one of those? That's fine by me.
I don't know. I think I tend to be like pretty responsive to just the writing. If I like the writing, even if it's a terrible review, I'm going to like, nah, I can see that. That's a pretty good case against why this is awful and we should stop immediately. But then if it's poorly written and it's just, I don't find it to be like a very, I don't know, convincing argument or, so I'm just like, nah, what do I do with that?
Well, now that could be a dangerous thing. I mean, if somebody writes a review of...
So potentially it's in the hands of somebody else to shut us down. So people,
there was that one guy.
Haters should try.
The British guy who basically gave us a great review of the new album, but he pretty much dismissed everything we had done before. It was like,
oh, was this the guy in The Guardian?
Yeah.
Well, I do remember that because it was actually a fairly well written from a technical point of view.
Right.
It was a well composed essay.
Yeah.
So what do you do? I mean, you can't look back at everything you did before Swing Low Magellan and say, oh, he's right, that's all crap.
Yeah.
No, I wish that instead he would have been like, oh, now I get it, instead of, oh, everything they did before was, you know, pretentious, hipster, blah, 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 something like that is what he said.
But you can't envy the critic's position also, because you have to, probably if you're a critic, you have to, you know, take some sort of, you have to have an angle, you have to have some sort of edge, and you have to, even if you're endorsing something, like really fully, you have to bring some sort of barb that indicates that you're thinking critically, right, or that you know the history or whatever. I mean, at least I think a lot of critics feel like they have to do that.
Well, you know, when we were talking with Joe Keyes of eMusic about this, he was saying, you know, critics are, in a sense, they're in a kind of a weird position because...
Mm. Especially now, in when everything is so democratized, it's like, what is the role of the critic isn't really a, you know, it's not really a, is it a necessary mediator? I mean, there are tastemakers, but... More often, those are things like labels or something like that.
Well, and that's a question for a whole nother time. It's like, you know, when the media has become so democratic and everyone has access to it, you need some kind of gatekeeper somewhere. Otherwise, you're completely at sea, and it's just too much. You don't know what to do with it all. Mm. Dirty Projectors with us on Soundcheck today. They're playing, along with the chamber group Y Music, at Carnegie Hall on Friday, January 11th. This next song is called Impregnable Question. Once again, it's Dirty Projectors live on Soundcheck.
If there is ever the impregnable question of why, what did or didn't pass, it would help to say comfort in destiny. But I really don't, we don't see eye to eye. You care if I take or I don't. I will always hold what we shared so long to be the only love, though we don't see eye to eye.
Once again, Dirty Projectors, live in the Soundcheck studio, performing the song Impregnable Question, which you'll find on their 2012 album called Swing Low Magellan. And the album Swing Low Magellan, I mean, I've seen a number of people reference the Magellan, you know, the Portuguese explorer. The Swing Low, is that a reference to the old spiritual, Swing Low Sweet Chariot?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
Yeah.
Do these things just come to you and then you try and figure it out later when
that
it comes?
That phrase did. And then, yeah, like there was a whole round of, you know, when the album first comes out and you do a lot of press for it and all that, and everybody was like, oh, what does this mean? And I don't know. I mean, yeah, swing low, sweet chariot, that's about like surrendering to death, mm-hmm, right, and finding mm-hmm. like redemption in that. And then Magellan is the explorer. Now, hold on a minute. I had an answer for this. I
don't need it.
Putting those two next to each other, I don't know. I think, like, I didn't, for me, like, at the time, it felt like it was pretty much purely a phonetic thing. But then putting those two themes of kind of, like, surrender and also discovery next to each other. Yeah.
Let me ask you about Portlandia. Are you're going to be in Portlandia this season, right?
I think, yeah, we are. Yeah, we were on tour, passing through Portland. We had a day off, and they film in the summer in Portland because it's mm-hmm. beautiful there in the summer. And
we've been mutual friends with Fred and Carrie for a while.
That's Fred Armisen, Carrie Brownstein.
Yes, sorry. And we've been talking about doing something kind of loosely for, you know, a couple of years, and it just kind of worked out.
All right, I'm not going to ask you to give anything away if you're supposed to be tight-lipped about this, but do you play? I mean, are you
in a sense?
Say in a way, kind of.
In an abstract way.
That's all I can say.
That sounds like a Portlandia. That sounds right. All right, so guys, it's been 2012 was a big year. 2013 getting off to a big start, Carnegie Hall. And Joe from Twitter is going to have to be satisfied with the I'd like to answer to his question about whether there will be yet another record this year.
I think there will be.
Okay.
But, well, yeah, we should hedge our bets. We would like that.
Okay. It's been great having you guys here with us in the studio on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much and good luck.
Thanks for having us, John.
This is Soundcheck. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, join us at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org for a live audio stream of our recording session with Red Barat, the Brooklyn-based Bhangra party band. Red Barat live at 2 on soundcheck.org. Then on the air at 9, Adele's record 21 was the top-selling album of 2012. It was the second straight year. We'll find out whether she can pull off the three-peat and what the other year-end sales numbers mean when our regular guest Joe Levy of Billboard magazine joins us. Plus, the jazz violinist Zach Brock has played alongside musicians like bassist Stanley Clark and sax player Chris Potter. Now he's got his own group as well. The Zach Brock Quartet joins us to play songs from their debut album called Almost Never Was. We want to hear what you think of Soundcheck, what you like, what you don't, and what you think we should be highlighting on the show. You can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org, and get updates and exclusives from us by liking us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, @Soundcheck. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.